Hello and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. $95 million more dollars flowed into Hawaii this past February than in the same month last year. That's according to the Hawaii Tourism Authority, and the increase represents an almost 8% gain from a nearly 2% spike in visitor arrivals. So how come state revenues seemingly aren't feeling the effect? Despite another record-breaking tourism year, the Council on Revenues report recently revised its state forecast from 3 to 2.5%. And while the go-to answers are often offsets from sectors not performing as well, plus ongoing obligations, we wondered whether there might be something else leading to the disconnect of revenue flow. Marilyn Niuwau is the vice chair of the Council on Revenues and is on the line with us now. Aloha.
Aloha.
Thanks for making the time. Now, you make the point that to interpret the HTA numbers and then look for a balance in state revenue is too simplistic. Why?
Well, in my opinion, forecasting tax revenue collections for the state of Hawaii is increasingly challenging. Because of structural changes in the way consumers and businesses are conducting business and purchasing goods and services in the internet age, I believe that past tax collection averages and trends no longer are reliable indicators of current and future tax collections.
So why has that changed, or how has that changed, and what do you see as being the points behind that that we should be considering as we look at these top-line numbers?
Well, I think that, first of all, you have to take a look at the over tax collections. Of the total Hawaii General Fund tax revenue collections the state receives, the Hawaii General Excise and Use Taxes account for approximately 52% of the total tax collections. The Hawaii General Excise Tax is imposed on Hawaii businesses on their gross receipts. In addition, the use tax is imposed upon Hawaii consumers on their purchases of out-of-state goods and services for use in Hawaii.
So I think you're making the point that this is really a much smaller part than we think about it when we see these wonderful numbers coming from HTA.
Yes. If you look year-to-date, hotel rentals and construction contracting appear to have solid tax revenue growth. But hotel rentals and contracting only represent approximately 18% of total Hawaii General Excise tax collections for the current fiscal year. Therefore, despite the recent glowing news of big visitor spending increases of 7.7% in February and positive growth in visitor arrivals of approximately 2%, overall general fund tax revenue growth is roughly 2%. And essentially flat after adjusting for inflation.
So Marilyn, are you saying then that we have a tax structure that's not necessarily consistent with where we are right now in terms of business and the way business has been evolving and growing and the way people's behavior has changed?
Yes. In my opinion, tax collections are less than what I would expect, given the apparent strength of the economy, because the current tax structure is becoming less effective in the evolving economy and ongoing demographic changes. One way to see it is to use the analogy of a fisherman casting his net to harvest fish, or in this case, the state of Hawaii collecting tax dollars from the underlying economy. I see four large holes in the tax net of Hawaii: online retail sales, online vacation rentals, outsourcing of services, and the underground cash economy. In order to close those holes in our tax net, we constantly have to re-examine our tax laws and their implementation to ensure that the state has adequate funds to finance its programs.
So as you look at the system right now, given the four points that you've just made, what do you think has to be done most immediately to be able to address at least some of those points?
Well, I think that we probably should look at where the revenues the biggest source of revenues. Retail, which makes up nearly 40% of total Hawaii general excise tax collections, is an industry in flux. While year-to-date tax collections from retail are relatively flat or declining if you factor in inflation, a drive around the many of the shopping centers reveals an alarming amount of vacant retail space. This trend is not unique to Hawaii. It is happening across the nation as brick-and-mortar stores struggle to compete against online retailers who offer free shipping and no sales taxes.
But isn't that changing, for example, like with Amazon?
Yes, except for Amazon is not remitting all of the amounts that you buy from Amazon. It's only a portion that they have, and they won't remit the amounts due from third-party vendors.
So what happens with the use tax?
Purchases of goods and services for use in Hawaii are supposed to pay the use tax on those purchases. However, the use tax oftentimes is not paid by consumers, and so this is a constant struggle. We're trying to have legislation to fill the gap or try to capture that use tax on purchases so people's behavior will be reflected in taxes collected by the state.
There's also the issue of how tax rates for higher income individuals has changed. And we've been talking about this for a while now with the Tax Foundation. But looking at what happened at the in the tax rates last year, when they went from 11% to 8.25% because that temporary legislation expired, you say that's also a problem.
Yes, that would affect the current year fiscal year collections for 2016, and so you won't have as much income collected for this fiscal year. And also, the state received a one-time $39 million lawsuit settlement from Expedia and other online travel companies during the last fiscal year, which they will not receive in the current fiscal year. So those types of items explain why we won't have as much of a growth in the current fiscal year as, for example, in prior years, or as what we might expect.
So generally, when you hear, when you hear some of these numbers that we have heard now for several years from HTA, and people see the headlines for that, it's hard to remind people that this is only a part of the story, although you might think, well, of course, we would logically think that. How then do you have to recapitulate this whole system in a way that average people will understand that there may be a need for a real change of the whole tax system itself?
Well, it's a very complicated to try to change the tax laws to try to tax online retailers and outsourcing vendors because they live out of the state, because they do not have what you call physical presence or nexus in the state. So trying to capture taxes from those retailers or vendors is very difficult. And I would suggest, my personal opinion, is that if everyone buys locally in Hawaii products, goods, and services, it will help the tax collections in Hawaii and also the economy in Hawaii.
That's not necessarily great news for online retailers who see the world as their marketplace, and maybe even for some Hawaii retailers who buy into that idea, too. I hear you say that it's tough to really chase those retailers and get back what they're supposed to be paying. But aside from that part of the equation, what else do you think has to change in Hawaii so that we perhaps can better some of the other points that you made concerning maybe, personal income tax? I'm sure people who are in higher tax brackets don't really want to hear that they may be booted up to 11% again.
Yeah, we have a big problem here because we have Hawaii's aging population means that there are demographic changes, less consumer spending, and therefore less taxes collected, and much of the retirement income for retirees would be exempt from Hawaii tax. So we really have to look at the tax structure in the state to try to capture what taxes we could from the underlying economy, even if the economy appears to be a strong one at the current time.
We know that that's going to move into a less strong position in the coming years. If you had your druthers in the world, according to Marilyn Newell, what would you do first to be able to stem that just a little bit?
Well, I would encourage people to buy local. That would help with the economy. I think that we really have to take a look and try to see whether through legislation we can capture some of that income that is not being taxed because of out-of-state sales and consumption of out-of-state services. And there's one other thing is you know, the airlines have cut back on their luggage. You know, you have to pay for luggage now. And if you think about where you're going to be buying items in Hawaii, if you have to pay for luggage, then people would be less inclined to buy things in Hawaii and then take it back. They'll more often try to ship it back to their home, for example, or not buy at all. And that would mean that there would be less taxes collected in the state.
I want to thank you for the time that you're able to give us. Look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you.
Marilyn Niuau is a Hawaii-certified public accountant and attorney. She's president of Niuau & Roberts, CPAs on Maui, and has an almost 40-year career. She's the past board president of the National Society of Accountants, a state director of the Hawaii Association of Public Accountants, and the vice chair of the Council on Revenues.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaii Theater Center, presenting Release the Hounds, an evening of acoustic music featuring Julian Lodge, Chris Eldridge, and Aoife O'Donovan, this Saturday, hawaiitheater.com.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, the ancient art of kite flying, but first, here's your backyard quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about a different type of kiting, the kind that involves open water and being strapped to a board. Kiteboarding, as it is known, is a relatively recent sport, having come of age only in the last 20 years. However, its evolution has been extremely rapid. In the mid-1990s, pioneering kiteboarders were still having to develop the specialized equipment necessary to propel a rider using only a kite. Flash forward to 2017, and kiteboarding is a full-fledged professional sport, one that almost appeared in the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympics. Now, as it happens, Hawaii turned out to be one of the best locales on Earth for kiteboarding and its many subdisciplines. And there's one Hawaii beach in particular that is known the world over for its kiteboarding conditions. For today's quiz, we want to know the name of that beach. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer.
Aloha, I'm Kyle Itani, chef owner of Hopscotch Restaurant. Join the conversation on Twitter. Talk back to your radio at HI Conversation.
Kite flying is not as easy as it looks, as anyone who has propelled his creation straight into a tree can tell you. It's an intricate and ancient art that will be on display this weekend in Lahaina, Maui, at the Chinese Kite Festival. Master kite flyer Robert Loera is on the line to tell us more.
Hello, Chris. Thanks for having me on the show.
Sure. You've been involved with flying kites for quite a while. When did your passion get underway?
Well, early 80s in Honolulu with Alfred Chang and Lincoln Chang, which were the previous presidents of the Hawaii Kite Flyers Association.
Uh-huh. And were you part of that group I see down at Sandy Beach all the time?
Well, there was actually two rival groups that brought it to a peak there in Honolulu in the 80s. I was actually the group that was across from the Kaimana Beach Hotel in beautiful Kapi'olani Park.
Oh, sure, sure. Well, what kind of variety of kites do you see these days?
Well, you know, it's interesting because they have more like art kites. So a lot of the kite artists of the 70s and the 80s, they kind of went into designing interior structures for, buildings that were being developed in the future. So those artists actually have gone into much bigger projects, but still, I guess they tie the roots to kite flying when they first got started, like this Mr. George Peters that we have returning to Hawaii after 40 years.
Uh-huh. Art kites, is that a sort of a specialized category?
It is indeed, because the kite artist himself makes it from start to finish. So the engineering in terms of framing is extremely kind of critical. But the interesting thing is that the skins or covers that they put on the kites themselves, a lot of times are done in repetition or they're done in patterns that are very confusing to the eye. So generally what will happen is the kite artist will come up and put up 40 extraordinary kites that just kind of float and move, and they have a rhythm in the sky that is kind of it's a very peaceful feeling.
So you can get, depending on the pattern of your kites, you can get quite a spectacular look when they're in motion, yeah?
Amazing, yeah. There are quite a few of those kites we have on display actually in the cannery right now. So we have them hanging. I've had three or four giant kites over 20 feet in the ceiling, including a beautiful Chinese kite or centipede kite from George Peters that stretches about 60 feet long.
I find it amazing that you could even get something like that airborne without it getting all tangled up.
Well, that's what makes us experts.
I suppose. Well, what's the engineering component of making kites?
Well, materials are extremely important, you know, the wind conditions. So there are kites that are created for strong, gusty winds, like you would say trade winds.
Mm-hmm.
And then these more traditional art kites, which like a lot of wind under 18 miles an hour, tend to prefer winds much like the soft Kona winds, you know, in the 10 to 15 mile an hour range. They don't vary very much.
So when you're going out to fly kites, I would think you'd have to pay a lot of attention to wind conditions and pick your kite accordingly. Is that true?
Pretty basic, yeah. You don't want to get overpowered. Mm-hmm. So if you go out and the wind's blowing 15 to 35 and you put yourself up a 500 square foot canopy, you're in for some excitement if you don't know what you're doing.
I would imagine. How far back does this history go?
Well, pretty interesting thing they say that. You know, I've seen in the early 70s, there was a magazine that was called Kiting that I think was produced by Mr. Bob Ingram, if I recall correctly. And on that cover, I remember a 30-foot-wide kite made by a Filipino family in Honolulu. And it was amazing because back in the early 70s, they figured out structurally with natural framing, right, like bamboo. They didn't have fiberglass and carbon fiber like we had in the 80s and 90s.
Mm-hmm.
So it was intriguing that in the 70s that there were quite a few master kite makers in Honolulu that made kites over 20 feet regularly.
What's a good standard size, let's say, for somebody who wants to get involved in the sport but, doesn't have any experience? What's a good way to get underway?
Oh, the funny thing is, you know, you just go out with your family and you can go out on a light Kona wind day or a light day under 10 miles an hour. I'd go out with a $5 kite and have a great experience. I think you only need to invest $200 or $300 into a kite when, you know, you want to be seen. You know, that tends to make more of a statement. The kite could be more maneuverable, it could be larger, it could be more colorful. So it doesn't require very much investment and very easy to make a basic kite at home with just ordinary materials like bamboo and plastic trash bags. So you don't have to invest much to get into it. It's just a matter of can we go back to that old, you know, follow the instructions and make something basic out of basic materials and feel satisfied with it.
You say, but you also talk about kites that do involve a $200 or $300 investment. What are those made with the materials you mentioned, fiberglass, things like that?
That is incredible. That's a great question because in my mind, you're right. What changed from the 90s to now is the creation of kites bigger than football fields. with no framing at all, using actually a tensioning system internally with lines to keep the parachute material into a certain shape. So, you know, those are easy to see online. Go to peterlinkite.com from New Zealand, and you'll see kites in every shape possible, including 300-foot humpback whales.
A 300-foot kite.
It's a frameless kite. Yeah, they're called ram air. They're very similar to how the principles of parachutes work, where the wind went inside the holes of the pukas. So these kites have huge mouths, and they inflate the air. And since the parachute material captures the air, it doesn't escape, right? Because there's not an exit point. So it becomes a big, fine-shaped, three-dimensional that can be flown with probably lines that are 2,000 and 3,000 pounds, tense lines. So, you know, the bigger the kite is, the harder the pull.
Well, at some point, is this kite going to pick you up and carry you away?
If you don't know what you're doing, you're right. But most of these kites will only be displayed when the wind's about 5 to 15, so it's relatively very safe. When the kites are on the ground, we kind of do the same thing that you would see in a balloon festival. We won't be doing that this year. But you can walk 1,000 or 2,000 people inside the kite. It's so large. A beautiful kaleidoscope of color. I mean, kite festivals are fascinating. We're only in our fourth year here, and, you know, it's a great thing to see. But the kiting and kites are amazing, and April is National Kite Month.
Yeah, so I hear. I would expect that you're seeing, do you see a kind of a growing number of enthusiasts at each year's festival?
Well, the beautiful thing is about it is I was somewhat retired from the kiting. You know, I was big in the 20s going to the international festivals. But now that I'm in my 60s, it is because of great people like the Woking Museum and Dr. Busa Bayef that has recognized that I have a talent and a love of showing kites. And recently inherited another huge kite collection, which we'll be showing off on Sunday as well. So we've got a lot of surprises. We want people to come out, see what we're doing, and we're continuing the tradition of the Hawaii Kite Flyers Association here in Maui. And anybody who wants to join us, please come out. It's a community event. You know, it's all about having fun and just being with each other. It's a great event.
And there's quite a bit of skill involved just in handling, especially one of these specialized kites, I would think.
You're right. The big kites I kind of like to do, and they're not as pretty, but they do a lot of lifting duties. And so, but Mr. George Peters will put up with the beautiful artistic kites, which of course will captivate everybody. And then we have a visiting kite flyer from Honolulu, Scott Ogdenbog, which is a multi-line flyer. That's another way that, well, we know that in kite surfing, right, multi-lines, it's more than one line. And it's the same thing with a kite flying. There are a lot of multi-line kites, four-line kites that you can kind of control, similar to what you're doing, controlling the wind, spilling the wind off of the wind when you're on a board with a kite. But they're smaller, more maneuverable kites. They're used generally for kind of razzle-dazzling the crowd. You put a tail on them, and you hover and float them, and, you know, you knock a hat off of their head. But kiting is a lot of fun, you know. It's not.
It sounds like it, Robert.
Anybody can do it.
Well, thanks a lot for talking with us, Robert. Master kite flyer Robert Luera will take part in a Chinese Kite Festival this Friday and Saturday at Woking Museum on Front Street in Lahaina, and you can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tory Richard Limited, celebrating more than 60 years of design for the island lifestyle. Tory Richard is proud to support local community news, public affairs, and talk programming on HPR.
The Hawaii Attorney General's office says public testimony cannot be censored, and that the state Senate was wrong to do that about a proposed bill. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Hey there.
Hey, Beth Ann.
So what happened with the state Senate? I mean, how did they apparently deny the constitutional right of a person to submit testimony on a bill?
This concerns a bill that regards pregnancy information, providing that to people that need it. To use another word for it, abortion information would be included. The bill's controversial. There are several centers that are affiliated with religious organizations, and they oppose this bill because they feel it infringement on their First Amendment rights, and in this case, the freedom of religion. But there's another issue at play here, and that's the freedom of speech. It's a little convoluted, but in a nutshell, a testimony that was submitted was deemed to be in violation of a federal medical privacy act. This is something that Senate President Ron Cochi felt strongly about, and so they literally took down testimony, would not post it publicly on the website, as is the norm for all legislation, for all testimony. The Attorney General's office says you can't do that. That's censorship. There's no reason to have done such an action.
Okay, you mentioned what we know as being the HIPAA law. You can't, you know, put information,
correct,
personal information out about somebody and health conditions. So just without violating that yourself, can you talk about what happened with this piece of testimony and what put it into jeopardy to where it was regarded as being something that should be censored?
A group called A Woman's Place in YPO, it's part of a Calvary church, submitted the testimony. They took issue with the testimony of someone who works with Planned Parenthood. In essence, they shared information about an exit survey that this other person took after they had visited the YPO clinic, information about how they felt about their experience and did they like the staff and all that. And that's the concern about the privacy. Once the YPO group found out, they went to Breen Hariamoto, the state senator, who, by the way, opposes this bill. And he was very concerned. He asked the attorney general for the opinion on this. He then also tried to change the Senate rules to say, hey, make all testimony public. That was defeated Friday by Senate President Ron Cochi. It has been a bit of a struggle among leadership and ideals over this very fundamental First Amendment right.
And what happens to the HIPAA privacy issue with the person who was named in the testimony that was censored?
You know, you can read the testimony. It's on our site, depending on one's point of view. It revealed some information. Others might say it's fairly mild. I'll let the reader make that determination. I can tell you that the Attorney General's office said, look, this is not in violation of the federal law. That is not a problem. So this is something that Senate President is going to discuss with their own attorneys. Breen Hariamoto will be involved. He said he'd like to resolve this before session ends, which is May 4th.
All right. Well, I guess we're going to find out what happens with this, but a very interesting and convoluted situation.
Yes, it is.
Thanks, Chad.
Thank you, Beth Ann.
Have a good day down at the Capitol. Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today with reporter Chad Blair. The Senate Committee on Judiciary and Labor says drug paraphernalia possession and delivery offenses are nonviolent. Its opinion moved a bill to reclassify and decriminalize drug paraphernalia, and if it passes, the measure would keep the offenders or would-be offenders out of the criminal justice system. But according to the latest version of SB 1501, it would carry a more hefty civil fine of $500 instead of $100. Carl Berquist is the executive director of the Drug Policy Forum of Hawaii. He's down at the Capitol today for the bill's third reading, which happened just a little while ago. Carl Berquist is on the line with us now. Hello there.
Aloha, Beth Ann. How are you?
Doing all right, thanks. And what happened now with 1501?
Well, it wasn't as dramatic as one might have expected. They actually did not discuss the content of the bill. It was put on the so-called consent calendar along with a host of other bills. And basically that means they didn't discuss it on the floor. They voted 25-0. It passed unanimously. And senators have the option to enter any comments into their journal. So we'll keep an eye on that. But next up, we're headed for conference committee, or the House and the Senate will work out their differences, including that issue you mentioned, the fine.
That $500 fine seems to be really difficult to swallow when it was in a previous incarnation of the bill or version, $100. Why that pronounced difference?
Well, so the initial bill had language of a flat fine of $100. The current bill has language of a fine of no more than $500. So there's going to be discretion allowed for the court to set that fine. But depending on, I think, pressures on them and others, we're still concerned that they might opt for the higher amount in order to secure more resources for the state. But conversely, if you set it too high, then people will not be able to pay it. We already know people have a big problem making bail, and some of these same individuals that we're now trying to help by not putting them in prison for this offense, we're worried they're not going to be able to pay such a hefty fine. So we're hoping to get it down to a smaller amount than is currently in the bill.
What would be an amount that you would think would be reasonable?
I'd like to say I would like to see it back at 100, which is a common fine that is you see in other states for this type of offense or general possession offenses, especially if non, like something that is nonviolent or a drug that is not harmful to the individual or not extremely dangerous to the individual. So $100 would be sort of the baseline that we're aiming for. But we'll see what kind of compromise. But I do like that there is discretion. So I think there should be a no more than language in the bill as it is now.
It seems that this is really being viewed as a marijuana bill, is it?
Absolutely not. It is. There are individuals who are advocating for it in that way. But I think a lot of the people that are currently in prison with this as the lead charge, so this is the most serious conviction. We have about 150 individuals currently are in prison with this as the most serious offense. And I doubt if many of those, if even any, have it as a marijuana or cannabis drug that was connected to the paraphernalia. More likely other drugs such as heroin or ice.
But the idea of decriminalizing this from a felony to something that would be subject to a civil fine, it seems to have also a lot of good things in it for not clogging up a system that's already overburdened. Is that very much behind the idea of how this has been moving so, well, relatively well this session?
I absolutely believe so. I think we're seeing a general movement in the state. We've seen it for years, and sometimes it gathers pace, sometimes it slows down. You know, we set up a needle exchange to help people instead of putting them in prison. We legalized medical cannabis in order to help people instead of criminalizing them and putting them in prison. And now we're seeing this. People who tend to have this paraphernalia and are convicted for it are people that most likely need help. They need some kind of treatment. And to instead throw them in prison for many years, whether they're repeat offenders or not, is not going to help those individuals. And it's certainly not going to help the criminal justice system focus on more serious offenses. And we already have such overcrowded jails. And as we know, the ACLU is suing the state for that with unconstitutional confinement conditions. And we're sending people to Arizona and confining them there. So to clog the system with nonviolent offenders who need assistance and treatment is the wrong way to go, and I'm very happy that the state seems to be realizing it.
So then switching gears for a moment and looking at a different bill, SB 174, that seems to be having a lot of difficulty getting agreement from the House and Senate and clearly headed for conference, but looking at what is the definition of a debilitating medical condition, to include lupus, epilepsy, multiple sclerosis, and arthritis. There are a lot of people who say, well, you know, those diseases seem to be pretty legitimate if somebody is seriously in pain and needs to have medical marijuana. Why do you think there's so much of an issue with this bill?
Well, I think my understanding is that the issue with those four conditions is kind of a minor one. I think there is an agreement, it seems, between the Senate and the House on those four conditions. There was a fifth condition that was in there recently that was removed, autism. And that was removed for reasons that we're still trying to decipher. We believe that there is enough evidence when it comes to autism that is certainly is almost, if not as compelling as for the other conditions. And in addition to that, there were some more general conditions like stress and anxiety that were part of the bill originally. Those were also removed. But I think the four conditions currently in there and autism, hopefully be able to pass the legislature, and then we'll be able to help more patients with medical cannabis.
And before we say goodbye, at least for this time, as you look generally at where the session is now and what has happened with a lot of the medical marijuana bills, how do you assess this session?
I think in terms of the medical cannabis bills, we're seeing one larger omnibus bill with different provisions. That's HB 1488. That also passed today on the Senate's consent calendar, and that's headed for conference. That includes conditions, that includes the ability for patients and caregivers to test their own medicine, even if they don't buy it at a dispensary. So we're seeing some improvements for patients' rights definitely this session. And we're going to have to see where it goes from there, and I think hopefully next year we can continue to see stronger improvements once the dispensary is open to see what exactly we need to do with the system.
And, of course, we're waiting for those dispensaries to open. Do you think that they're really going to be able to open by late summer or fall?
I sit on the oversight working group that looks at this, and we're meeting tomorrow, and we'll get an update to see what some of the licensees have to say. And, you know, from our understanding is that the seed-to-sale tracking system is in place. People are growing. They may already be making products. So I certainly think so. I think they're ready to go. So hopefully we'll see you this summer, if not the early fall.
All right. Well, on all those hopeful notes, we'll say goodbye for now and talk to you soon.
Aloha, Bethan. Thank you.
Aloha. Carl Berquist is the executive director of the Drug Policy Forum of Hawaii and is currently pursuing a JD at the University of Hawaii's Richardson School of Law's evening program. His work is rooted in the belief that the war on drugs is a failed punitive approach, and he focuses on ending the criminalization of drug users, and as you heard, is clearly in support of HB 1501, heard and passed along today.
Aloha, I'm Michael Clicks from Honeybee Management Services. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Now we're going to get back to our backyard quiz. Today we asked you to give us the name of a beach somewhere in Hawaii that's known around the world as the Mecca of kiteboarding. The sport evolved throughout the 1990s courtesy of ongoing technological breakthroughs in Europe, New Zealand, and the United States. Halfway through the first decade of the 21st century, the sport had come into its own with professional competitions and records set. Intrepid sailors began to use kites to attempt increasingly difficult open water crossings, including the English Channel, the Bering Strait, and even the entire Atlantic Ocean. Here in Hawaii, kiteboarding has gained tremendous popularity after ocean sport pioneer and Hawaii native Laird Hamilton demonstrated it on Maui in 1996. The location for those early tests was not happenstance. It was Kanaha Beach Park outside of Kahului, and it remains one of the most popular kiteboarding destinations in the world. It's also the answer to today's quiz.
And Beth Ann, Vanessa Lampson happened to be driving to Kanaha Beach Park and called up, and she's the winner of our quiz, but she wasn't the only one who called. It was a very popular quiz that lit up the phone line. So that is today's quiz, and if you've got a quiz for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. The ancients knew that music and the motion of celestial bodies were intimately related. The notion of musica universalis, our music of the spheres, builds on the mathematical relationships that hold the universe together. Composers ever since have freely speculated as to what celestial music might sound like, and Robert Pollack's Ebb and Flow Arts has been presenting concerts for more than 30 years aimed at answering that question. Robert has a program of new works coming up at the Windward Community College Imaginarium. He's with us on the line. Thanks for joining us, Robert.
Hello, Chris. Thank you for your continued interest in our presentations.
Well, it's pretty interesting stuff, you know, the whole idea of, and for one thing, combining music and visuals.
Oh, yes. It's a natural, of course. The planetarium is a wonderful visual experience, but it also has an excellent sound system.
So the whole idea is immersion, right? That you're given something to sort of feast your eyes upon as you listen to the music.
Yeah, it's a very, very immersive. It's also a fusion of art and science in the planetarium, musical arts and the science of the stars, astronomy, and so on. So it's a kind of a fusion on many levels. And we've been doing it, like you say, for many years. I started in New Jersey when I ran the Composers Guild in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
We felt like we'd go to these concerts in a concert hall with electronic music, and it was wonderful sometimes because the sound systems were fabulous, but there was something so deadening about seeing an empty stage with a couple of speakers.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
The question is this really the future of music?
Mm-hmm.
We used to be told years ago that, in fact, the electronic medium was going to solve all of our problems. You know, perfect renditions. You walk out of the studio, electronic studio, with a tape under your arm, and that's it. So it was really the future. But, of course, there are issues. That is that what happens 20 years later with a piece like that, it doesn't change. It's static. It
mm-hmm.
becomes really non-music at a certain point. However, the thought was, let's place this music in an exciting visual environment. So we teamed up with Planetaria way back when in Trenton and other facilities. Then they didn't have digital technology.
Mm-hmm.
So 1 year, the big advance at the State Planetarium was the director very excitedly said, we have a disco ball this year. but, you know, then the whole program went on hiatus as we moved here to Hawaii. I thought that was it. Until happened upon this Imaginarium. And so it's, you know, on the campus, like you say, of the Windward Community College. I talked to the director and really founder of the Imaginarium, Dr. Joe Ciotti,
mm-hmm.
and he was open to the program. And this will be on May 5th, probably our sixth collaboration with Imaginarium.
Well, Robert, also one of the things that you've done with Ebb and Flow Arts is open people's ears to music that is unfamiliar and challenging, right?
That's right. And this provides a wonderful portal, if you will, you know, visually to embrace the sounds as well.
Yeah.
You know, and we've done this also at the major facility on the Big Island, the Imaloa Planetarium in Hilo, which is a 3D facility. We have a wonderful technical producer, Peter Swansea, who's able to create these so-called full-dome films for the planetarium. And in this case, where it's a kind of tri-island synergy where we have musicians and artists from three islands, Big Island, Maui, and Oahu, participating. So it's a very exciting way to go for us. Definitely. And I couldn't have imagined in my wildest dreams that we would have these sorts of shows way back when, you know, with the anything that can be done on a computer screen now digitally can be projected onto the dome. So,
well, Robert, you use the term portal as a means of introducing people to, you know,
mm-hmm.
challenging and different sounds. And I think with regard to a great deal of modern music, a portal is very necessary. Well, if not necessary, yeah. at least extremely beneficial for a great many listeners. Do you agree?
I do, and we, as this is a free admission event, so we make our events barrier free, thanks to, for example, support from the Hawaii State Foundation of Culture and Arts, mm-hmm. and the Hawaii Community Foundation, Robert E. Black Fund, the Kasasa Foundation, ABC Stores, and others. We can make these events free, so that helps, of course, to open the doors, open the opportunity to listen. And as we've discussed in the past, you know, our role is curatorial. We feel the avant-garde has always existed, and in this nowadays, it's our mission to provide and offer these type events to the public, and we've gotten some very good responses. People love the Planetaria shows. The last one at Imaloa was an overflow, literally. Had to bring in many, many extra chairs and so on. So it's a popular event in that sense, and because, you know, the allure of the planetarium, it's just wonderful. But remember those? What was it? Rebel Without a Cause, that film where a lot of the scenes took place in a planetarium. You know, it has that mystery and magic. And again, it fuses art and science in a way that's quite powerful and entertaining, really.
Well, I think that you could make an argument for music as a fusion of art and science. It really...
Yeah, exactly. Because as you were saying, for example, Aristotle wrote that the motions of planets must produce a noise, since on our Earth the motion of bodies far inferior in size and speed of movement has that effect. Their speeds are in the same ratios as musical concordances. The sound given forth by the circular movement of the stars is harmony.
Well, so harmony is something...
From the ancient times, there was this connection of mathematics, music, the intervals, the fact for us that electricity and the starlight are similar, in a similar continuum, really.
Well,
and
Robert,
so it would be natural to place electronic music under the stars.
The ancients got a lot of things right, Robert, and thanks very much for talking with us. Robert Pollack is the founder of Ebb and Flow Arts, which presents music of the spheres at Hokulani Imaginarium on the campus of Windward Community College on Friday, May 5th at 7:30 p.m. It's a free admission event.
Support for today's programming comes from Hawaii Opera Theater, presenting Offenbach's The Tales of Hoffman, April 21st, 23rd, and 25th at the Blaisdell Concert Hall. Tickets and information at hawaiiopera.org.
At this point in our program every day, we get an opportunity to hear about things we might not otherwise have heard about. And Morning Edition host and colleague Derek Malama joins us for a look at events going on under the radar, such as an inspirational story to be told tomorrow in Hilo.
Yes, very inspirational. Extreme athlete Nikki Rellin will talk about surviving a 45-foot fall off a canyon in 2013. She recovered to become the first woman to hike the 2,200-mile Appalachian Trail on a prosthetic leg. It took her about 9.5 months to do this. This talk is happening at 4:45 tomorrow in the Hilo Public Library, and it's free.
Yeah, I think the opportunity to hike that particular trail would be fantastic. That's on a great many people's bucket lists.
Yes, I guess mine too.
And there's a new exhibit at the Peggy Hopper Gallery.
Yes, it's called Within, Without, and it features new work by artists Mary Babcock, Reem Vassous, Catherine Love, Hadley Nunes, and Maya Lee Portner. And the exhibit features drawing, painting, fiber, and photography. It addresses topics of political and social activism, femininity, and family history, and also a sense of place and identity. And the Peggy Hopper Gallery is located in downtown Honolulu at 1164 Nu'uanu Avenue.
Covers quite a bit of ground, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And here's one for children who might have a little bit of poetry in their souls.
They can bring out their inner poet tomorrow. The Kailua Kona Public Library presents a children's poetry workshop at 3 p.m. Play with words to enhance self-expression, imagination, and creativity with mixed media. The program is suitable for ages 7 to 12. Children must be accompanied by a parent or adult caregiver. The workshops will be limited to the first 20 children, and you can RSVP online at libraries.hawaii.org or pick up a ticket 15 minutes prior to starting time. Once again, it's at 3 p.m. in the Kailua Kona Public Library.
Poetry used to be something that was routinely taught to children, so that's a rare opportunity. Thanks very much, Derek.
You're welcome, Chris.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that might be going on under the radar. You can always find out more at our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, this is Will Shorts, Puzzle Master for NPR's Weekend Edition Sunday. You're listening to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, Margaret Atwood's dystopian novel, The Handmaid's Tale, envisions a world in which women are slaves. But to Atwood, her book was a kind of realism.
I didn't create that world. I reflected that world, and I put nothing into the book that had not already happened at some time to someone.
A conversation with Margaret Atwood, next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Sunday morning at 9, following Weekend Edition.
And coming up next time on The Conversation, which would be tomorrow, we're going to talk with the president and CEO of the National Association of Manufacturers. Jay Timmons will be here. We'll also hear about the Navy's Pure Praxis Sexual Assault Prevention Training Program.
And we'll get a preview of the upcoming Honolulu Theater for Youth season.
In the meantime, if you want to be in touch, there are lots of ways. You can leave us your comments on our TalkBack line. That's 808-792-8217. Or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. On Facebook, you can find us at Hawaii Conversation. Or you can tweet us at HI Conversation. And if you want to be in touch with me, you can find me at BKOZHPR.
And if you missed part of The Conversation or any other show that we air on HPR, you can find them all on the new HPR app. Search for HPR in the Apple App Store or on Google Play. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you tomorrow right back here for more of The Conversation.